All right, everybody, on today's show, we're going to be talking about Squeeze to the Max. Let's take a look at what's going on with GameStop and what's going on with this crazy world. Welcome to the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. This is Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, everybody, excited to dive into this week's episode. As teased, we are going to take a look at the squeeze, the short squeeze, the short, and maybe a little bit about what's going on with GameStop. And we actually have Brian Feraldi joining us back on the show today. Brian Feraldi has been a friend of the Choose a Fight community for a long time, been on the show many times, and we're excited to include him in this conversation and maybe add to our personal knowledge base. I tell you what, I was trying to explain to someone what a short and a short squeeze was about three or four times, and I got lost in my own mind multiple times. So I think this is a conversation worth having. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. And yeah, it's interesting, all these little pieces of terminology, right? Like, I would love to hear what your explanation was for a short sale, right? Like, even people like us who are in the personal finance world, like, this kind of stuff is not easy. And that's why it's so beautiful to have an expert like Brian come on.
Well, yeah, we go out of our way to keep it simple, right? Which means we don't really need to worry about things like margin or options or shorts or calls or, you know, all these things are really kind of unnecessary when you just keep it simple and you're a long-term buy and hold investor. Having said that, it's almost like this has cracked the public awareness. People recognize, even if they have no interest in investing, that something is happening right now that we haven't seen maybe since, I don't know, maybe in a decade, maybe a decade plus, in that people that are not interested in investing, people that are not interested in the stock market, suddenly recognize something's going on and I should probably at least like understand what it is. So I was like, let's have this conversation. Let's both get educated and let's continue it a little bit. So I don't know, man, what's going on in your world?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess first I just want to agree totally with that, right? Just like having any type of background information on things like that, it's just so critical to really understand the world around you, right? Like you hear this stuff, you might listen to the Choose a Buy podcast and say, oh, I understand buy and hold investing, but what are these people doing shorting stocks, right? What does that even mean? So while it's not necessarily certainly going to change my investing landscape and outlook, I think just having that background knowledge is critical. And it's similar to what we talked about with Bitcoin, right? Like a couple of weeks ago in my Fi Weekly newsletter, I sent out a video on understanding Bitcoin that someone in our community sent me. And it was really fantastic. And I mean, does that mean I'm going to turn around and start buying tens of thousands of dollars of Bitcoin? No, but having that understanding of how does this technology work, I think that is just important for all of us to have that background knowledge and then move forward intelligently. And I think, you know, we all are trying to understand systems. There are so many systems in the world. And actually, Jonathan, you asked like what's going on in my world. So our favorite foil here is the system of health insurance and healthcare in this country. And I had just a maddening situation this morning. So I need to get a CT scan, basically. And I, just like any normal person, would love to know, hey, what is this thing going to cost me? Right? Like a fairly rational question, one would think. So I scheduled the thing last night and they said, oh, just give a call over to your insurance company. Here's the code that you need to give them. They'll be able to tell you what this thing costs, right? Like what the negotiated discount is. Because as I'm seeing it on the hospital's website, the estimate for total fees is $2,093, which is ludicrous. And there is no way, seemingly, Jonathan, I spent 30 minutes on the phone. And I called my health insurance company and then I called the hospital back, spoke with multiple really helpful people, like genuinely helpful. They wanted to help me and they couldn't.
We don't know what this cost. You can't right, get price right. on something could you, like healthcare.
How could you imagine? It was the most, so what it reminded me of. So what they basically said was, okay, this is the gross charge, this 2093. We will not know what the negotiated cost is until after the procedure.
Oh.
After. And after we get together with your insurance company and figure it out. So this is almost akin to, have you ever looked at the back of the door when you stay at a hotel? Like that little document that's on the back of the door, it actually says the rack rate of the room. And it's usually something absurd, like $995. Like this is what this room costs. Now, obviously, that's not what you're paying for the hotel room, but this is akin to that. It's as if the hotel room said, oh, this, the rack rate is $995. We'll tell you what this actually costs you after you check out. So sucker, you have to deal with whatever we ultimately decide on. I mean, that's not the way the world is supposed to work. You know, like that's not the way this is supposed to work with the health insurance. But yet here we are.
I mean, I think what you're talking about is transparency. There is so little transparency in healthcare in the United States, the cost of healthcare in the United States. And I think, you know, to pivot a little bit, like to riff off that, well, obviously there's a level of frustration that comes with dealing with healthcare, and anyone inside the United States has slowly had that realization that it's just fundamentally broken and no one seems to have any vested interest in fixing it. Either party, you know, it's not even politics. It's just everybody's decided, yeah, we'll just, you know, stick it to them. But what's interesting is for the last decade or so on the stock market side of things, things have kind of just been smooth up and to the right. Back in 2008, 2009, clearly that was not the case. But for the last 10 years, it's been somewhat predictable at a macro level and people were either investing in it or not. It was, investing in using the system and investing or not. People would invest in the system with various levels of complexity. But now, speaking of transparency, everybody universally is saying, what is going on? What the heck? How does GameStop become suddenly 1,000 times more valuable? How does someone lose an infinite amount of money on GameStop? Humble little GameStop that tried to get me to sign up for their magazine subscriptions. And this was apparently their business model. Like, what? I haven't been in a GameStop in, 5 years. How is this the center of the entire financial community? Transparency, I think, is actually what we kind of wanted to have with this conversation, because there's like layers to this game, apparently. And there are hedge funds participating at a layer that we don't ever see. I mean, they're playing with amounts of money that are hard to comprehend, and they're making planned moves or bets that have been basically hidden to the masses. And apparently they got called on it and their shorts were down around their ankle, pun intended. So with that, Brian, welcome to the show, man. We're going to talk about the GameStop short. And I guess the first question is this on your radar? Is this something that people that are outside of maybe the investing community that you typically spend most of your time in, is this something that like friends, family members, other people are coming to you and asking you about just because they know that you're interested in generally in investing? Are they making some sort of connection between the GameStop and what it is that you do?
Hey, Brad and Jonathan. First off, it's good to be back. Nice to chat with you guys. And yeah, let me just say that the last couple of weeks have been some of the weirdest weeks in the investing world I've ever seen in my whole life. I always laugh to myself when people in my life that have no interest in investing, no knowledge of investing, suddenly start asking me questions about investing. And that has happened to me so much in the last few weeks. Just today, my mom sent me a text message asking if I knew what was going on with GameStop. My mom has no interest in investing, no interest in the market. So it just shows you how pervasive this story has gotten into mainstream culture.
All right. Well, that sets the tone entirely. So first of all, for the record, what is going on with GameStop is not your preferred method of investing. In fact, I don't even think it makes the list on how you go about investing. But just due to the research that you do, I'm sure that you are aware of it. So let's just start there. If you could give us a breakdown, what is going on? Is GameStop, is it valued appropriately right now?
Boy, is that a loaded question, depending on really who you ask. So let me just talk quickly through the mechanics. I think most people know what GameStop is. GameStop is a physical seller of video games. And for a while, GameStop was a fantastic investment because video games are becoming more and more popular. About 5 years ago, or maybe a little longer than that, GameStop's business prospects started to decline. A lot of people, rather than going to a physical store to buy a video game, started to just download their video games on their home system. We have an Xbox, for example. It doesn't have a CD player in it. There's no way that we can go out and buy a physical disc and put it in the game to play games on it. We have to download them directly from Microsoft. That shift in the landscape of video games is putting a lot of downward pressure on GameStop's business because the demand for physical video games or the need to go to a store to buy them is declining over time. For that reason, GameStop's stock as an investment has declined for many, many years. And people were making analogies between GameStop and other failed retailers in the past, such as Blockbuster or Circuit City. It's a very logical argument to be made that GameStop is going down. GameStop, the business, is going to cease to exist in a couple of years. And for many years, that thesis was proven to be correct. Now, if you are an investor or a money manager, there's actually a way that you can make money when a stock declines. That's called shorting the stock. It's not something that I personally do, but I do know people that do short stocks. The mechanics of a short sale, of selling a stock short, are basically the exact opposite of when you quote unquote go long a stock, aka you become a buy and hold investor in that stock. So the way that a short sale works is you go to your broker and say, I think this stock is going down. Again, let's pretend it was a GameStop and you thought GameStop was going to decline because you thought it had unfavorable long-term business prospects. You would say, I want to short GameStop at, let's just say, $10 per share. Your broker would go out and borrow shares of GameStop from another investor. It would then sell these shares for you at $10 per share, and then you would collect the proceeds of that sale. Your goal would be then to buy those shares back at a later date at a lower price. So let's say it all worked out well. You sold stock that you didn't own at $10. And then a few months later, let's say the price declined to $8. To undo the transaction, you would have to go in the open market and buy those shares, return them to the original owner, and then you would make the difference between that $10 sale price and the $8 buy price. So that is the rough mechanics for how an investor can make money on a stock going down.
Brian, just to jump in real quick. So that makes sense. That's the mechanics of short selling, right? But talk me through the investor who originally owned the stock and then let this investing house or whatever borrow the share, right? With the promise that it will be returned to them. Do they get some little amount? Like, what's the incentive for them at that point?
Yes. In order to sell a share stock short, the investor who is doing the short selling typically has to pay a small fee to the person that they're buying their shares from. So there is a cost.
To the person they're borrowing the shares from. I just want to make sure I'm getting the terms
correct.
Right.
Correct. So if I borrow stock from Brad because I want to sell it short, I would then have to pay Brad some fee to do so. Think of it almost like an interest rate on that stock. And in addition, because I have sold Brad's stock, if that stock paid a dividend, for example, I would have to compensate Brad for those missed dividend payments. So to go short a stock, there is typically a fee associated with it. The fee that you have to pay varies hugely depending on the stock. And generally, the more demand there is to short something, the more expensive it is to borrow that stock and to short it. So that is why you, the other investor that owns it, would be willing to let this happen, is that if you just want to own this stock, you can actually make money on it by letting other people borrow and sell a stock that you yourself hold.
That's interesting. Right. So in that case, in that hypothetical, I'm getting a small fee, some percentage or whatever it may be, plus I'm getting the contractual obligation that I'm getting this stock back in X amount of time, right? And I assume there's some contract for it has to be returned by X date, right?
Actually, there's not. You can short a stock indefinitely. That's why the words that they use to describe this are really interesting, because you hear the word short, you think, oh, maybe you can only do that for a week or 10 days or 2 months. You could short a stock for years. There's no actual time frame on it. However, there are rules about if the person that you borrowed the stock from then wanted to sell that stock that they theoretically owned, the broker would have to go out and find another short for you to borrow from. So there are some, again, there's a lot of like mechanics that go on, but somebody in theory could be short a stock for years.
This is interesting. Now there's a couple, let's now apply this a little bit to what's going on with GameStop before we get to the squeeze, which is where the Reddit comes in. Let's talk a little bit more about the mechanics here. This person that is allowing people to borrow stocks from the Brad just, you know, referenced and you just added some more detail. That is the part that I think has been a little bit mysterious. Like who is going to, like, if all of us believe that GameStop is going to Blockbuster levels, you know, if all of us believe that, who is allowing someone else to borrow from them? Is there risk to that person? Let's say Brad has a large investment in GME, a large investment in GameStop. And there's all these people that want to short it. How much risk does Brad take on by letting other people borrow stock from him to short said stock? Is it risky for him as an individual to do that?
If you ask the brokers, the answer is no. And in fact, again, if you are a long GameStop and you have this stock sitting there and you are betting that the company is going to rise, the pitch from your brokers is if you let us take this stock and sell it to you, you can essentially earn income on this stock that you would hold anyway. So they would share a portion of the payment with you, the person that is letting them borrow the stock. So if you are a believer in GameStop or any company, there is a financial incentive for you to let those shares be sold short. And if you are okay with that happening, it allows you to make money on a stock that you're going to hold anyway.
Okay, that is the crucial point. So if you're long on this anyway, if you're bullish that this is, you want to hold this stock, whatever it is, right, for a long period of time, you're not going to sell it anyway. So you are, in essence, you still retain ownership and you're getting this income, this fee for letting someone else borrow it, right? And then, as you said before, if in this hypothetical, I'm the owner of this huge lot of GME, which is hilarious, but if I wanted to sell it, I can still do that, right? Because you said then the broker would just have to figure this out and get someone else's share to loan to this person who's short on. Is that a fair summation?
Correct. If you are someone that has lent out shares of GameStop to somebody else and you are earning income on that, and then you decide, I no longer want to own GameStop anymore, you can undo that transaction and sell the stock. And then it's up to your broker to go out and take those borrowed shares and borrow them from another investor. So you don't have to worry about that on the individual investor side. This is all for your broker to take.
But this is actually the point, though. So if Brad says, I want to undo that transaction, I want to sell these because maybe it's going up, et cetera, whatever. Does that force a call on the short where the broker could not find someone else to loan it and to swap it out? Would that force a situation where they would then need to repay at the current market price? Is it something along those lines?
That's my understanding. Yeah. If the broker, for whatever reason, could not find any more shares too short, then it's my understanding that, yes, the transaction on the short side would have to be undone at that point.
So, okay, Brian, this begs another question, which is how do you get involved in this ultimately? Like, so for instance, I own the one individual stock that I own is Berkshire Hathaway. You know, I think we talked about this when you came on previously. I am long on this for probably the rest of my life. What if someone wanted to short that stock, how do I loan my shares out and get this income? Is that something that's doable, or do you have to have relationships with the brokers? Do you have to own significant amounts? Like, that might not be a question you can answer, but do you have any sense of how to get involved in that?
That would be a broker specific question. You can always call your broker and say, I'm interested in loaning this out for a short sale for a company like Berkshire Hathaway. I don't think there's a lot of people that are interested in shorting that company.
I want to short it.
So because there is likely to be very low demand for shorting Berkshire Hathaway, even if you did loan it out, the amount of money that you would be paid to do so would probably be inconsequential. Yeah. So you might not just want to hassle with it. A company like GameStop, completely different story. There was so much demand to short this stock that brokers were willing to pay a lot more in order to get shares to short. So it's always company specific. But to answer your question, that is something that some brokers do. My personal broker, for example, is Interactive Brokers, and they actually sent me an email saying, are you interested in selling some of your stock, allowing your stock to be borrowed and shorted? And if you do so, here are the terms we'll pay you. And I said yes, because to your point, Brad, I'm going to own these stocks for a long period of time. So if I can essentially get income from holding them even more, that sounds good to me.
Now, here's the next question as we kind of pivot into the second half of this, which is the squeeze. But like going through this short process, does that force the share price down? Does it have any impact on the actual share price of GameStop, maybe driving it artificially lower or getting it closer to its demise than it would have been in a natural market where this wasn't occurring?
Yes. When you go out and short a stock, you are putting downward selling pressure on that stock immediately because you're borrowing somebody's shares and then you are selling them to the market. So in the short term, once you transact on a short, yes, you are pushing down the stock price. Of course, that depends completely on how much money you're working with. If you or I were to do it, it would have no impact on the share price. But if a big hedge fund that's managing hundreds of millions or billions of dollars were to take a significant position short in a stock, that could absolutely drive down the share price.
Okay, Brian, let's dial in here on this, not necessarily with GameStop, but just the mechanics of buying and selling shares of stock and the price and how, as you're saying, downward pressure, but there is also upward pressure, right? If, as I understand it, it's supply and demand ultimately at the heart of this. But can you talk people through, like, okay, the price, if you go on Yahoo Finance or whatever, the price at this exact instant is X, but it's constantly changing. And I have to imagine, based on my limited understanding of this, that it's based on the supply and demand, and that marginal share that's coming on the market. Is there more downward pressure, more selling pressure, or more upward pressure? So can you, I guess, clarify that, because it's probably not precisely correct, and give us some sense of like how that works with that next price?
The price of a stock at any given time is simultaneously the lowest price that buyers are willing to pay and the highest price that sellers are willing to sell at. That's all the market price of really any good is. It's the marginal demand for that stock at that particular time. And this is why stocks fluctuate up and down. Take a stock that's worth, say, $100. There are some buyers out there that will say, I'm willing to buy this stock at $99.75. And there are some sellers out there that'll say, I'm willing to sell this stock at $100.25. And the price is just the matching up of the price that buyers and sellers are willing to pay with the volume or the number of shares that are willing to be transacted at any given price. And that's all the share price moving around on any given day is. It's what's the difference between those two numbers.
So if the market says for a stock, you know, the market price is $10, and you know, there's some amount of volume that's being bought and sold each day, and then suddenly, because people were able to borrow stocks and flood the market with it in this extra kind of short manner, now there's twice as many, you know, stocks maybe available for sale as there were before, but the buyer level is still the same. And since buyers weren't buying it at $10.99, now will they buy it at $10? Will they buy it at $9.50? Will they buy it at $9.40? Will they? And then at some point, more buyers get very excited because, wow, look, a deal. And they buy it there, and then that becomes the new market price. And that's happening because the supply has exceeded the demand. The supply's cost needs to go down until it can attract new buyers, or more buyers that are getting, you know, greedier or seeing opportunity. And as soon as those two match up, that's the new fixed price, and vice versa.
Yeah, that's exactly how you think about it. And of course, this has all become far more complicated today because most of the trading that's done on any given day is done by computers that are pushing shares back and forth to each other with fractional of a penny's difference. If you wind the clock, say 30 years ago, the spread between the buy and the sell was much higher than it is today because there's so much more volume, and it's done by computers and in microsecond transactions. The spread between those two prices has compressed. These are all just the mechanics of how to buy and sell a stock on any given second of any given day. And if you're a long-term investor, this stuff really doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter for our investing strategy. It does matter for those of us that are trying to explain to friends and family what the heck is going on. So that is why we're doing this conversation. So let's pivot into the second half of this, which is what got these, because shorts happen on most stocks other than Berkshire Hathaway, apparently. Shorts happen on most stocks. There are people that take long positions. So most of us are buy and hold investors. We're saying we're here for the long term. There's shorts on many of those stocks. Hey, I think there's going to be some volatility here because of some event that's on the horizon that maybe people aren't factoring in. There's an opportunity. I'm taking this position for whatever. Now, if that's happening all the time, what stood out about GameStop specifically to make this a target of, I guess we could say, first Reddit and now the world? What was it about this that made it such an outlier? Because the actual thesis is kind of decent. GameStop's going to be the next blockbuster. I think most of us probably, even if we're like, yay, look at what's happening, are saying, yeah, that's probably true. That's probably true. What was it about the GameStop short that got it on the radar of this particular subreddit?
That's a really good question. That I don't particularly understand why the Reddit group became so interested in GameStop. I can tell you that the amount of people that were betting against GameStop was huge. I mean, the number of shares, actual shares that were sold short on the market was extremely high, especially when compared to the total number of shares that were available for trading. In GameStop's case, there were more shares sold short than there were shares that were publicly traded. This is something that is very rarely can happen, but it can happen. And there's many articles online that can explain this in greater details than I can. But
I just want to say that out loud again so that people like make sure they sell. Are you saying that? So, you know, you could sell 100% of GameStop shares. That means you would sell the entire company's value. But in this case, they were selling over 100% of the shares short. Is that an interpretation of what you just said?
Yes.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like that should be possible.
It sounds crazy that something like that could happen, but that just goes to show you how many people out there were betting that this company was going to go down. The subreddit group, Wall Street Bets, decided to take the other side of the trade, and they said, no, if you look at the fundamentals here of the business, it's not as bad as many people were making it out to be. And if you dig into the details, there's a very logical argument that what happened to Blockbuster will not happen to GameStop, because the fundamentals of the business are just different, and the balance sheets of the business. So Blockbuster had a ton of debt. GameStop's debt level is more manageable than Blockbuster's was. So while the long-term business prospects may not be favorable, there was a logical argument to be made that at certain prices, GameStop was very undervalued. That at, say, $4 or $5 a share, that was far too low of a price given the fundamentals around GameStop. When Wall Street Bets decided to take the other side of the trade and said, hey, we're betting that this company is going to go up, once that happened, a famous short seller named Andrew Left from Citron Research published this scathing piece out there, and he basically said GameStop is going down hard. And that really was the moment that inflamed the situation and really was like a rallying cry for the people on Wall Street Bets that were bullish on the stock, that were betting the stock was going to go up. When they got together and they decided we're going to buy GameStop, that started the price of GameStop to rise. And you don't want the price to rise if you are short the stock, because you are losing money as the stock price go up. And that actually kicked off what's called a short squeeze.
All right, now we'll talk about the short squeeze in a second here. And I know Brett has one more follow-up question as well. I just wanted to point out that there's kind of two levels to this. One is the thesis. And most of us have done this as a theory. All right, I think GameStop's prospects are bad over the long term because Blockbuster. And the other one is, well, I actually think they're better than you think because subscription model, because brand awareness, because products can be sold online, because you pivot to whatever. These are two, you know, theories that are competing. Both have some level of value. But now we've actually moved off that. And you talked about inflaming. We'll just say it got personal. And one side said, I will destroy the other because I understand the mechanics of what's happening here. And if I can cause XYZ result, the other side will self-destruct. It's moved from one to the other. And now we're in a totally different level of this as opposed to just what's the theory. What is going on has nothing to do with the thesis anymore. Is that accurate?
That is correct. Yeah. What's happened to GameStop? There is no, in my opinion, at least, there's no logical argument that you've made that GameStop was worth $4 per share in December and then $400 per share literally 3 weeks later. What has happened to GameStop's stock has been purely a result of a short squeeze, as well as this immense buying power of Wall Street Bets, all these little investors that banded together to drive the share price up. So GameStop stock has not been trading on any fundamental business reason for the last couple of weeks. And that's one of the reasons why it got so much attention.
Yeah, this is fascinating to me. So basically, so this short squeeze, I think we need to talk about that, because as I understand it from like the Wall Street Bets standpoint, now, again, like I love how you have your Brian hat on and talk about the fundamentals of the business and you can understand the thesis. And that all made sense maybe between $4 a share and $20 a share, or, you know, whatever. We can make up a number. But right, clearly, once it started getting 100, 200, 400, this is now just really, as I'm seeing this, like understanding the rules of the game. So this Wall Street Bets subreddit saw this and said, okay, there is a massive, massive short on this. And because we understand the system that there is going to be this pressure for these people who are short to buy it back, which, you know, you can talk about the short squeeze, but it almost seems like if, as you said, when they got together, you use that phrase, and I love that. And that is really what happened. This subreddit got together and said, hey, there is an almost mathematical certainty based on the overwhelming short positions on this, that if we all get together and buy, that they, the quote unquote, they, the people who are short on this are going to have to buy back into it in this short squeeze, which then further increases the price. So, I mean, because they got together and they understood what was going to happen in, again, almost a mathematical certainty, not quite, I'm not saying that, but like that, just from a strategic standpoint, forget fundamentals, because this has nothing to do with fundamentals, but from a purely strategic standpoint, it's pretty brilliant, you have to say. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And also, if you can talk through the short squeeze and how that works, because nobody understands that.
Yeah, so let's go back to when GameStop was trading at $4 per share, or
which
near
is not its, that long ago, right?
In
right?
December, share, yeah, ago, which was a multi-year low, and the valuation of the company or investors, the way that investors were valuing the business at that point, were essentially pricing it for bankruptcy. The market price indicated that this company was on a path towards bankruptcy, which again is a seemingly logical argument given GameStop's prospects and its balance sheet, et cetera. However, the market seemed to have gone too far in that direction and wasn't paying attention to the real details of the business. But anyway, that's a different story. Either way, the prevailing wisdom amongst people that short stocks was GameStop is going down. And they so believed that they borrowed and sold short a tremendous amount of GameStop's shares. And that in itself was one of the reasons that GameStop was going down.
Okay. All right. So to be clear on that, I just want to introduce that term. What you just described was you're buying on margin. Are you saying that basically to take their short positions, these hedge funds actually borrowed money in order to carry out this bet that they made, this short bet that the GameStop stock was going to continue to go down?
Well, one of the interesting things about shorting is that it's literally the exact opposite of going long a stock or buying it. Again, let's say you buy a stock for $10. What's the highest that share price could go over time? I mean, in theory, there's no upper limit. I mean, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, these are enormous companies that have gone up a tremendous amount, and they're still growing to this day. So investors who bet on these companies years and years ago have made huge multiples on their original investment. When you go short a stock, the exact opposite math works for you. So when you short a stock, what's the most money that you can make on it? Best case scenario, if you go short, is a company goes bankrupt and its stock goes to zero, in which case you make a 100% return on your money. However, if you're wrong, how high could that stock go in the other direction? There's theoretically no limit on how high the stock can go. So let's say, again, I short a stock at $10. Well, if it goes to zero, great. I make a 100% return on my money. If that $10 stock goes to 100, not only have I lost all of the money that I did shorting it, I've actually lost 10 times the amount that I put into it. So because of that, if you go short a stock and that stock goes up a lot, you can actually lose more money than you put into the stock.
All right, there's a timing piece of this that I'm curious about, because you said there doesn't really have to be an end date on the short. It doesn't have to be this amount by this price. It can be an indefinite short. So my point is, at what point do you have to pay up? You know, like, could you just say, well, yeah, you were able to raise the price, but I know at some point the end is going to happen for this thing. So for 5 years from now, you know, that's my short. I think it'll be at whatever price I want it to be 5 years from now. Does the part where this is costing you a lot of money in the short term, does it still matter to you? Like if the price jacks up, you know, 100-fold, 200-fold, you know, 2 weeks in, does that cause you financial pain?
Of course, yeah, it causes you big time financial pain. And it's common if people have a short on that they say, okay, if this stock goes up, say 20%, I'm just going to cut my losses. Like, so if you shorted the stock at $10 and it went up to $12, you would just say, I'm cutting my losses here. I'm capping this out and I'm going to get out of the stock. Now, the number that would take to get somebody out of a stock is different for every investor. You could say some saying, I'm going to get out at 15, I'm going to get out at 20, I'm going to get out at 30, et cetera, et cetera. However, if you've seen what's happened to GameStop, GameStop went from $4 to, say, 20. So if you shorted GameStop at $4, you are now down many multiples on your initial investment. And because of that, a lot of shorts want to get out of the trade. They're saying, this is not working, I'm wrong for whatever reason, and they want to get out before the amount of money that they lose goes up from there. One of the mechanics of short selling is, again, you sell a stock at the beginning. How do you get out of a trade? You have to buy that stock. And when you put buying pressure, when you introduce demand for buying the stock into the market, what does that do to the share price? It makes it go up. So what happened with GameStop was all of these short sellers that were betting against the stock all of a sudden saw the stock price rise dramatically because of Wall Street bets. And to get out, to undo that trade, to say, this is enough, I've had enough, they had to go out and buy the stock themselves, which just put further upward pressure on the stock, which convinced even more short sellers, I need to get out, which put even more pressure on the stock to go up in the short term. That is why the stock went from $4 to $400 in a matter of weeks.
And to put numbers on that, people aren't investing $4 or $10. They're investing millions, maybe $1 billion in some cases. So if you have, you know, a couple $100 invested in this position and then it 100x's, you are beyond toast. So you have to exit your position sooner than later, which forces everyone behind you to be an even more screwed position.
Yeah, you can see, I mean, pretend that you're running a $100 million fund and you want to devote, say, $5 million to this GameStop thesis that GameStop's going down. Well, if you're wrong and GameStop triples, you've not lost $5 million, you've lost 15. And that's all of a sudden 15% of your fund. So you can see why that would be leverage against your fund in the wrong direction and why you would be so desperate to undo that trade as soon as possible. So when you see what happened to the share price of GameStop over the last month, it's understandable why so many big money managers that were betting against this stock really got hurt from this trade.
Right. I mean, this is fascinating. So these big money managers are, like you said, they're selling into a price rise, right? Because they need to, in essence, cut their losses, but they're just magnifying it for themselves, for that next share, right? Themselves and their colleagues and such. But I guess going back to Jonathan's question, which I think was really interesting about the timing of this. So now this might not be practical reality of, hey, these hedge funds have investors who might want their money back, or they might see, hey, we're on paper wiped out. But just bear with me here. So thought experiment. Nobody thinks that GameStop is worth $400 a share, right? None of these hedge funds would be buying shares to, I guess, undo their short position at 100, 200, other than because they're trying to cut their losses, right? But what if they took the longer term? And again, this would require almost saint-like patience on behalf of their investors. But if they could paint the picture that, hey guys, this is really only worth $15 a share at most, it's going to come back down to earth. We're going to look insolvent basically on paper, but 6 months from now, we're highly likely that this is going to be back in a normal range and we can buy those shares then, as opposed to buying in this absolute panic and locking in catastrophic losses. Like, is that something that a hedge fund would be able to convince their investors of? Or are there regulations that I would be unaware of in this kind of hypothetical? Because, like, for me, this is pretty clear that this share is not worth $400 and I would never buy into it to undo my short at the risk of certain catastrophe. You know what I mean?
Yes, I understand what you mean. And it just shows you what the hedge funds are thinking, because even if you were convinced that GameStop was worth, say, $2 per share, that that's market value, and its current market value is $100, if your fund is losing millions upon millions of dollars every day, not only do you have to have the resolve to hold through that, you have to convince your investors to have the resolve to hold through that. And Remember, if the share price is rising, if you lent out shares of GameStop, what would you want to do?
I want to buy.
I would want to sell.
I want to sell.
I would want to sell my stock. So I would want to say, I want those shares back that I lent to you so I can sell and liquidate my position. Again, what does that do to, on the broker level? The broker would then allow that to happen and then would tell the short, we have to go find new shares of GameStop to short. You can imagine that that fact alone would make it extremely hard to just keep the trade on. So while in theory, you can short a stock for a long period of time, there's a whole bunch of mechanics and psychology in the background that make that extremely difficult to do, especially when you have a share price doing what GameStop has done over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's astonishing how there's just layer upon layer of complexity and, like you said, psychology built into this. And that's why, I guess, going back to what I said before, which was kind of a tongue-in-cheek, but maybe not so much about the mathematical certainty of this short squeeze if this group got together. So, I mean, they understood the rules of the game and they said, wow, there's going to be pain for these hedge funds if we do this, right? And I guess my question to you is, why has this not happened before? Was there something unique about GameStop? And I guess, you know, the follow-up question, I don't want to ask three questions all at once, but like, why is this not going to happen again and again?
Well, short squeezes are nothing new. If you look at the history of the market, there are plenty of times in history when, not this exact thing, but a company was heavily shorted, that company came out with good news, and then its share price just skyrocketed. So what has happened with GameStop from that sense is not unique. Short squeezes have been happening for as long as shorts have been around there. What makes the GameStop situation unique is that it was a coordinated group of buyers on the other side that banded together through Reddit to force this to happen. That's what kind of makes this situation, one, unique, and two, gives it the immense gains that we've seen in GameStop.
You know, as we're saying that, I wanted to point out maybe one other layer to this, which is if any of you have ever taken out a margin loan, invested, basically taking advantage of leverage, you know that if your investments go up, you have extra room to invest, or it really works to your app. But if your investments go down, if you were to then set, like, there's usually some sort of limit that you're allowed to invest with this amount of margin, and beyond that, you need to repay the broker, repay the lender. And so you could put that in reverse, and you could say that a hedge fund that is using leverage, or even if they're not using leverage, but they're engaging in a short and the short works against them, even though technically they haven't had to buy to exit their position, they have a negative balance with the broker, a dramatically negative balance. So any moves they make beyond that point, selling out of a different stock or unrelated stock, but it's attached to that broker, they're going to be required to settle to get back to some sort of range in order to continue to invest. So their entire business potentially comes to a halt until they resolve what's going on with this short position that's working against them. At least that's how it would work for us, like at a personal level. If you invest with margin and your investments all go down, if you add new cash, you're going to have to resolve the balance. If you sell out of another stock, you're going to have to resolve the balance before you'll be able to really continue. Or your broker could do a margin call where they call your balance. So there's a bunch of other factors that I don't necessarily know if these funds are having to deal with that, but I suspect it's on their mind.
Hey everyone, we're going to be right back to talk about Robinhood and how they changed the rules on trading right after these quick messages.
Now, we were talking about Reddit and we're talking about banding together. And while this story really has this kind of Robinhood appeal, it's interesting that that is actually the platform that is at the center of a lot of this controversy because it appears that there was a little bit of change in the rules involved, which, you know, while it didn't eliminate the entire pain for the hedge funds, it could have been oh so much worse. So, Brian, can you tell us what happened here? You know, because clearly they were able, the Reddit ban was able to 100x the price of GameStop, but there were some other things that happened in the background, some change in the rules that got people even more upset than they were a week ago.
Yeah, in Robinhood's case, Robinhood is a broker that has made a name for themselves by allowing anybody to get started and to buy and sell securities for $0. They're no commission trades. That's one of the reasons why they've become so popular with new investors. You have to ask yourself, all right, if this company lets you buy and sell for $0, how do they make money? How does this company exist, let alone be a $1 billion plus unicorn with a valuation? The way that Robinhood makes money, or there's a couple ways that they make money, but one of the ways that they do that is by selling your trading information to high frequency traders. So if I'm on Robinhood platform and I go to buy, say, a share of Apple, Robinhood will take that order information, aggregate it together with all the other people that are trading on Robinhood, and then it will sell that information to hedge funds and to high frequency traders so that they can literally say, okay, these Robinhood traders are looking to buy shares of this. And because if they know that information ahead of time, they can go in, buy that shares of Apple, put a small little markup on it, and then sell it to the Robinhood trader. And that information is very valuable to them because, again, they are trying to make money on micro transactions that occur in small fractions of a second. So when you think about it from that perspective, who is Robinhood's actual customers? The customers are not the people that are buying and selling stocks. The customers are the hedge funds that are paying them for the information.
I want to point out just real quick that I believe that what you just said is actually pretty common knowledge. It's known that this is actually their business model. In fact, most brokerage platforms that offer zero commission trades are doing a variant of this. This is quickly becoming, a lot of people learn from what Robinhood did, and a lot of different platforms are offering this. What makes it so interesting is that Robinhood tees itself up to give you day trading. It's set up for day traders, and this is much more relevant for day traders than it is for long-term buy and hold investors. Brian, is that accurate?
Yeah, and to make things even worse, you mentioned a margin account before. If I go to, say, Vanguard and set up an account, I fund it with cash, and that cash is used to buy funds. If you set up an account on Robinhood, by default, you are going into a margin account, which means you are borrowing money from Robinhood to make trades. So people that are signing up for Robinhood by default are set up to use a margin account, which you can, as you teed up before, can get people into trouble. So there's a lot of things that I don't like that Robinhood does. However, if you are using the platform to just buy and hold, it's nice to be able to buy and hold things and pay $0 commission. But to your point, it's important that you understand how Robinhood makes money and who the actual customers are. Now, when it came to the GameStop scenario, their clients that were betting against GameStop were losing so much money that Robinhood made the decision to stop trading of GameStop and AMC and all these other red hot stocks, so that their clients, who were these hedge funds, could actually undo their trades. Understandably, that really upset a whole bunch of people that were on this platform, because big clients, hedge funds, were allowed to continue trading to undo their positions in GameStop, but small investors were not allowed to buy and sell. Understandably, that made a whole bunch of people really upset.
Yeah, especially for a company named Robinhood, which theoretically should be looking out for the little guy. I mean, that's ridiculous. And what you're describing with their entire business model reminds me of Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, right? Where these high frequency traders, I mean, they're setting up, at least in my recollection, they're setting up these crazy fiber optic cables to get into these stock exchanges nanoseconds earlier than anybody else, and literally spending tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars just to get those couple little nanoseconds. So that's just in general, they think it's so lucrative that they can make potentially billions of dollars over so many of these trades, even at a half penny or whatever at a time. And then if you get into a scenario where Robinhood is taking basically the dumb money, quote unquote, which is their own, theoretically, the people who think Robinhood is looking out for them, the investors who open an account on Robinhood, if they're selling this information to hedge funds to get ahead of it, so that hedge fund can just buy it and then sell it a couple seconds later to the Robinhood client, right, for a little bit extra money. I mean, how many tens upon tens of millions of dollars are these people making at the expense of the Robinhood investor who, again, they think they're getting a good deal, right? Because they're not paying $7.95 in commission on a trade. But what are they really paying? Man, that would be fascinating to look at. Like, if you trade a lot, what are you actually paying in premiums to having your information sold ahead of you for hedge funds just to make money off of you?
You know, it's funny, Brad. I'm going to take the devil's advocate position. I actually don't really mind that at the micro level. Like, what they're doing is they're giving the illusion of free. I agree. They're giving the illusion of free, and they're clearly making money by selling this. But for the small investor that's not moving the market, and not doing a bunch of trades, I think it probably works to your benefit, and it's probably less.
Right, for the buy and hold investor. Yeah. For right.
Yep.
So like you and I, if I went into Robinhood and bought Berkshire Hathaway, and maybe I'm paying 25 cents extra, maybe 5 cents extra on a share, but I'm not paying the $7.95 in commission.
Exactly.
Yeah, I probably come out ahead. So yeah, agreed. So right, we're not disagreeing there. But yeah, I think in totality, this is probably really screwing over there.
What we're getting is the highlighter on what it looks like when this goes wrong and when your incentives are not in line. And so clearly being a band of everyday people trying to compete with a hedge fund using basically the hedge fund's platform for the everyday people, we're seeing what can go wrong.
Yeah, that's correct. And to your point, Brad, if you're just a buy and hold investor, there's nothing wrong with, in my opinion, in using a platform like Robinhood. If you just want to put a company in there and then benefit from its long-term movement, the downside to Robinhood is because it gives people a margin account and it makes buying and selling so easy, it really encourages people to trade and to trade rapidly. Now, to your point before, the markup on any given trade is a few pennies at most. It's usually a fraction of a penny. But from the hedge fund's perspective, that's essentially risk-free money because they're buying something at one price. They know what they're going to sell it for just a few picoseconds later. So why not front run them and essentially capture that spread? And so many people have done this that, to my knowledge, the amount of spread that's been captured has been reduced over time because there's so many people that are doing this, which is why speed has become such a big big component, which was pointed out in Michael Lewis's book, Flash Boys. But that's all, again, the extreme mechanics of it. But I totally agree with Jonathan. If your goal is just to buy index funds or great companies and hold them for a long period of time, none of this should really impact you. It's when people go out and want to trade and they don't realize that they're selling their own trading information to people that are trading against them. That's when it just shows you how hard it is to make money from trading.
Brian, you actually just made me realize I quoted the wrong Michael Lewis book. I said The Big Short, but it was Flash Boys. I've read all of his books, and I kind of conflated the two. So thank you for the clarification and being so kind there not to call me out on it specifically.
And, you know, I think for our audience listening to this, as we kind of put all this together, like, what does this mean? Well, for in the FI community, I don't think it really means anything other than, you know, know why we do what we do. You know why most of us on this call are skeptical of day trading to begin with. You know, when you're trying to enter and exit the markets with extreme precision, the system is kind of stacked against you. Like we've just, you know, revealed in one capacity how it is, but it's so much worse. You saw the exchanges actually got shut down, you know, to benefit people, not you. That's stacked against you. That does not apply when we're talking about buy and hold investing. For buy and hold investing, this is just mostly noise. You know, it's understanding the fundamentals, it's buying for the long term. It's not easy to replicate over time what just happened with GameStop. And just know that people at the top of their game, you know, these quote unquote hedge funds with all Harvard and Stanford grads, likely, you know, that with all of their brilliance applied, they just ate their breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, it got really ugly for them. And that doesn't happen to you. When you're a long-term buy and hold investor, yes, you can experience extreme loss. Your money can go down 30, 40, 50, 60%. But if you have a long-term buy and hold strategy, really all that means is that now you can buy at 30, 40, 50, 60% off. And over time, if you can just keep up with the market, you're going to do exceedingly well. You're never going to lose 600% of your money, 800% of your money, 1,000% of your money. That's not possible with long-term buy and hold investing. It's really important just to kind of understand that and understand simplicity. And I also wanted to point out, and I'll give this back to Brian, this is not to detract from long-term buy and hold investing of individual companies as well, individual investing. This is something completely different, and it's important to kind of draw a line in the sand and say, Brian, what you get excited about, you know, is not what we are discussing today. And I'd love for you to kind of, you know, what's your big takeaway for people that actually give you longer than 5 minutes to ask you about GME? What's your big takeaway? Like, what does someone learn from this and take with them into the next chapter of their investing journey?
Well, I think one of my favorite writers is Morgan Housel, and he kind of summarized what's happened with GameStop perfectly in a tweet earlier this week. And he said, the GameStop thing is a reminder that investing is not the study of finance. It's the study of how people behave with money. And sometimes those behaviors are incredible. And that's really exactly what has happened with GameStop. You can't make any argument to me that what's happening with GameStop is the study of finance, the study of valuations, the study of business prospects. It is merely today's versions of the tulip bulb saga or the trading sardines a couple of hundred years ago. Every now and then, bubbles come along in these financial assets, and just the price just does absolutely crazy things in the short term. But none of that should change your focus if you're just a long-term buy and hold investor. I know everyone here absolutely loves index funds. For almost everybody, they just take all the craziness that's going on with this just completely out of the picture. You're just buying and holding wonderful businesses that compound shareholder wealth for years and years and years. And on the one hand, I'm happy when things like GameStop happen because it makes people that have no interest in investing at least get it on their radar. They can start to answer questions about it, and it raises the public awareness of investing. On the other hand, what things like GameStop do is encourage the wrong investing lessons, which is, oh, if only I got into GameStop at $100 per share and sold it for $400. That's not investing. That is gambling. That is trading. That is kind of the exact opposite of the things that I expound individual investors to focus on.
Hey, Brian, if I could just pivot just for a second, I had a question for you. So we, this past Monday, we brought on Brian Barnes, and he's the founder, CEO of M1 Finance, the finance super app. And we just did this breakdown list of features. And by the way, that episode, if anybody hasn't listened yet, is amazing. I think for long-term buy and hold investors, you know, if you want a platform that encourages solid long-term mindset, M1 Finance is one to check out. But having said that, we've been kind of talking about some of the different features. And one question that we get a lot is socially responsible investing. And it just seems to be something that people are concerned about. I know I had asked you, we'd done a small segment with you like a year ago. What does it look like now? And I'm just curious if you have any updates for us on that. Like, because I believe your options have gotten, you have more options than you used to have, and the fees that used to be attached to trying to invest with diversity in index funds has also become more available as well. I was just wondering, is that anything that you could speak to? Are there ETFs that you could access that, you know, would offer a lot of the diversity we talk about while keeping your fees as low as possible and, you know, some sort of combination thereof for the people that are interested in that type of investing?
Yeah, there's been a huge rise in the demand for ESG funds, which ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. And it's essentially investing in companies that have some type of ethical component to them. So maybe they want to minimize their impact on the environment. Maybe they want to have a board that has people with a diverse set of backgrounds on there. Or maybe they want to invest in companies that run on 100% clean electricity. Or maybe they just don't want to invest in oil makers or gun makers or, you know, whatever the thing they don't want to put their money behind. So that's the basis of what ESG investing is. And we've seen a huge rise in the interest in ESG investing over the last 10 years. And whenever there's a demand built to invest in something, you can always count on investment companies to come up with ways to create products that let investors do just that. And I think that even Vanguard is getting in on this, and they've actually created some funds that are ESG focused. Whenever you have a huge increase in the number of funds, that typically leads to the price that you have to pay to get into those funds to decline over time as the demand goes up and there's more competition for these funds. And of course, when Vanguard gets into the game, commissions just, the expense ratios just drop like a rock. So yeah, there's a plethora of ETFs, mutual funds, index funds that investors can go into to ride the ESG wave. The only tricky thing I will throw out there is the exact definition of what ESG investing is varies from person to person. So you have to, if you don't want to invest in, like I said, gun makers, just make sure that you read through what ESG means to any particular fund to make sure that it's actually investing along the definition of ESG that you have.
Okay. And so the key here for people, if you're listening to the M1 episode that we put together and you're thinking, well, can I invest in socially responsible funds via that? The key is that M1 Finance does not offer mutual funds. That's the key term. They don't offer mutual funds. They offer ETFs. So if the mutual fund has an ETF version, for example, and this is not a ESG fund, but VTSAX, which is a total stock market index fund, that is a mutual fund, but it does have an ETF version called VTI. You can get VTI on M1. It's something similar. So when you're researching your funds, you just look for ESG funds and look for great resources around that. Find something you identify with and see if they have an ETF. And then you can find that ETF on the M1 platform and you can make a basket around that. Now, we've actually put together an article to kind of tee up for you how this works and how it might work for you. And Ed, actually, our CEO here at ChooseFi, has put together a free course as well, just to kind of show you how it might work. For more information on that, go to choosefi.com/M1 for more information. choosefi.com/M1. Brian, this has been awesome, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
I always have a great time talking with you guys. So thanks for having me.
All right, my friends, definitely a different type of episode, but a really important one for all the reasons mentioned. This is not our path for investing, but it is actually the introduction that a whole new generation of people will have to investing. A lot of people are going to be excited and feel like they missed out. A lot of people are going to get burned and lose a lot of money. A lot of people are going to be thinking that investing is just a giant casino. And it's important to be able to explain what this is and what it's not, and then provide a simpler path and one that's replicable. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
If this episode was helpful to you, don't forget to subscribe. If you want to help spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends about us. We can be found on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere you listen to podcasts. While you're there, don't forget to check out our other shows like Everyday Courage with Julian Johnsrud and Rebel Entrepreneur with Alan Dalmagan. If you would like a free bite-sized course to jumpstart your financial independence, check out choosefi.com/challenge. ChooseFi is produced by Andrew Mendonza and Zachary Tan and is a production of ChooseFi Media Incorporated. ChooseFi.com is managed by Annie Sheely with William McVeigh, MK Williams, Melissa Lagerquist, Liz Kessler, Stephen Hettig, Kelly Black, and Jennifer Ma. And Ed T is our CEO. Thanks for listening.
Oh, it gets worse. Like we start talking about Robinhood and was it the DTCC? Is that what it is? Where they have like all this, like, because they loan on margin. They don't always have all the cash in their accounts. And so they're basically being held liable for these short positions as well. And like Robinhood's balance sheet was about to get destroyed also.
And yet the number of Robinhood signups that have happened in the last 3 weeks are all-time highs.
Millions, right?
Yeah. I mean, before this, they had more people signed up than Schwab. They were bigger than Charles Schwab with the number of users. And it's just gone parabolic since then.
Well, apparently the Wall Street Bets group has some deep pockets now. So when this thing collapses or when they sell it. So this is my real question that we didn't ask on the show. But when Wall Street's Bets decides to exit before it comes back to reality, because I don't think GameStop's going to stay at 400 for whatever. Do the shorts now win or there's no shorts left because they've all eroded? So now it's back to a pseudo free market and it's just selling. Like if people are just trying to get out before all the money's gone. Like, does anybody win when the price comes back down?
Yeah, if you had a short on the whole way through, you would certainly benefit, or if you were able to short the stock at 300, 400, right? I mean, I'm sure you had to pay through the nose to do so.
But how would you have paid through the nose? Like there's no like collection until you exit your position, right? So that was the part that
the fee that you had to pay to borrow
the stock. I mean, again, it could be like 30 or 40%. So in other words, if you, maybe even more. So like if you spent $1,000 to short it, you would have to pay $300 per year.
So you're picking up a fresh short at the higher price. You're picking up a new, you're like, this
if
is-
you could.
Yeah, if you could, right? If somebody could. Would actually let you. But and Jonathan, just to add a little flavor to Jonathan's question, or Brian, is let's say the person on Wall Street Bets, you know, clearly there are some really smart people in there. There's some big money in there too. But not even talking about those sophisticated people, just the people who came on at the end and, hey, this is a cause. I'm going to keep doing this. It's $300. I'm buying with, you know, my stimulus money. This is what I got. Like that stock's coming back down to $10. Like that person is just going to feel the pain of losing 90%+ of their money. Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, but that's the reality of how the market
is
works.
Down
right?
Like, $95 today. It's at 130 now.
Yeah. So if you bought it 400, you know, with
you're down a lot quickly.
Yeah, you bought 3 shares with your $1,200 of stimulus, and yeah, you're down 75%.
I never understood
that cause was great.
People that get excited for like pump and dumps, and they're like, oh yeah, let me hop in, and the stock's already like doubled and tripled in price by the time the pump happens, and they're like, oh, I'm gonna die on this cause. Well, you're gonna die on that hill alone, my friend.
Yeah,
because GameStop, that is not my cause. No sir, not make me money first.
That's how a lot of people get started investing.
Yeah.
I mean, it just is. Like, I could tell you, when I first started investing, I was buying penny stocks, which were terrible, obviously, but I lost money and I learned fast.
Yeah.
Right. So there are a whole bunch of people that are going to learn really fast the hard way.
I can't imagine, Beans. The only thing that I would imagine would push that price up past 400 is the short squeezes exiting their position by buying. I can't imagine. I know there are, they exist. I cannot imagine a GameStop, you know, Reddit person or me or any of us saying, all right, I want to get this price to 1,000. So let's go buy it at 400 because we're going to make them bleed. Like, that's cray cray. But on the flip side of that, if you need it, you know, I'm wondering, that's really what I'm wondering. How many of these Reddit people were actively buying at the $100 and $200 price versus they were buying at 4, 10, 15, 20, 30. They got it, you know, pushed up to that point. The shorts got scared, started having to sell out of their massive positions. Then that squeeze pushed it up to 400. And then at that point, all the Reddit people were doing is say, well, I'm not going to sell. We're going to hold. Now that's different. Now that's what I'm hoping for them. That's different than the person saying, let's keep buying it. Let's keep buying it.
Sadly, I think it's a bit of both, but I think there's more of the let's keep buying it. You know, if you listen to like some of those, the Discord servers, you know, yeah. Like Brian was saying before, like, you know, per Morgan Housel, like a lot of this is psychology. A lot of it is herd behavior. Like
it's humans, all psychology.
You know, yeah. Like we are, you know, group social animals, you know, like the group was saying, hold the line. We're going to take it to them. Like sadly that, yeah, there's gonna be a lot of pain for a lot of those people. A lot of pain. Yep.
All right. Well, we'll just stay over here on the sidelines with our popcorn. Watch the
That's
show.
The markets. Yeah. And by the way, when you see stuff like GameStop, like when you see stuff like this happening, and this is your only exposure to the market, how would you not think investing in stock market is stupid or it doesn't work, right? How would you not? Because this is the only exposure that so many people have to the stock market. It's like, that's it. GameStop didn't work out. Therefore, investing is rigged.
Right.
Like how would you not take that?
It's a casino.
Hence why a lot of work to do to convince people. No,
yeah.
No, not how it works. But anyway.